it's the country. Today is September 11th, 2023. We appreciate you joining us at the country. Check us out at www.thecountry.news and on the X, the Twitter, at JWTheCountry. We're on Facebook. It's called The Country Podcast.
Country clothes and 100-foot yachts.
We've got a lot to talk about today. Out there in the country, hardline Republicans are itching for a shutdown and impeachment fights. There's a race to the bottom amongst our criminal presidents. But we begin today with the tragedy of 9/11 and the tragedies of 9/11 that still plague us. We owe it to the victims and veterans to learn the lessons of the war on terror. Today we remember the brave souls we lost in the horrible terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Al-Qaeda terrorists led by Osama bin Laden carried out a desperate attack on New York City and the Pentagon, hijacking four planes and flying them kamikaze style into the towers of the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon. The fourth plane was famously brought down by patriotic passengers who got word from their loved ones and crashed that plane rather than let it be used as another cursed arrow in the heart of the free people of America. 9/11 stands out as a day in history, like Pearl Harbor or the moon landing, in which everyone who was alive remembers where they were when it happened. We remember sharing hugs with strangers, crying and praying quietly together with hope and dread for the coming days, months, and years. We seldom reflect, however, on the other ways our society changed post 9/11. Before the attack, America had won the Cold War. The Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and Germany was reunified in 1991. That same year, 15 former Soviet states declared their independence, and the Soviet Parliament in Russia voted to disband itself. America spent the 1990s in a huge post-war economic boom, fueled by Reagan tax cuts from the previous decade and the Internet revolution, which led to the first balanced budget in memory and the dot-com craze and subsequent bust of 2000. America was now the sole superpower in the world. Russia was unstable. China was still very much a third-world country, having just been allowed to enter the World Trade Organization in 1998. The Middle East continued to see violence, but was generally stable. The Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, and there was some hope for a peace process that would lead to more stability. The Afghan Mujahideen had defeated the Soviet army in the late 80s. Little did most know, it was also consolidating Sharia law and power under a new authority, the Taliban. That despite many secret warnings, that singular event shocked Americans and changed the world. America was suddenly under attack, at war with a new power scarcely any Americans had heard of, Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist organizations. Commerce was completely halted as the nation came to grips with the new normal. Men with machine guns soon appeared at our airports. We started taking off our shoes and undergoing more rigorous screening. The country was given a new color-coded warning system that seemed to systematize and compartmentalize our grief and our fear. Even if those measures had little practical effect, they inexplicably made us feel a little more safe, which was the intent. Our government next told us that we needed to go to war to stop Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and we were all in. Patriotism thrived. America came together in ways it never had before, and President Bush enjoyed the highest approval ratings on record as he galvanized the country for war. But the war wasn't fought by everyone. The volunteers that joined to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq came predominantly from the poor and the lower middle class. Many of them gave their lives. Many more came home with wounds that never healed. To this day, they commit suicide in alarming numbers. In such alarming numbers that it's a national crisis. And yet to many of us, the world went back to normal somehow, and we were insulated from the effects of that war, like children who couldn't handle the truth. We were told in order to help the cause to go buy stuff and get the economy going again. Consumerism grew. Security concerns were paramount, with ever-increasing signs of protection, including gated, guarded new communities with driveways dominated by warlike Hummers, Jeeps, and Suburbans, which were all the new fad. We invaded Afghanistan and subsequently Iraq. Our nation spent the next 20 years fighting endless regime change wars in the Middle East for little benefit. The war on terror cost Americans countless lives and $21 trillion. And we have precious little to show for it. While we were gallivanting across the Middle East, killing hundreds of thousands in a misguided attempt to build new, free, Western-style democracies in nations that had no want nor need for such a thing, China was prospering. We later found that our military leaders believed for a long time what we just started to suspect, that the war on terror had no goal. It had no exit strategy and continued for decades because our leaders were afraid to admit failure. We also traded our security for liberty at home. The Patriot Act enabled our government to spy on American citizens, to collect their private information without due process, and later, to censor citizens' ideas the government did not like. Despite warnings from Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and other heroic journalists and whistleblowers, these policies continue to this day. We have sacrificed our liberties in a Faustian bargain for a deeply misplaced alleged safety. Meanwhile, China, with a long-term plan and focused leadership, became the next superpower. They grew to be a potent economic and military force. They have infiltrated our governments. They have infiltrated our think tanks, our universities, and our homeland. Many countries which used to call the United States a friend are now economically, if not politically, allied to China. It is a matter of time before China presses its advantage around the world with serious consequences for the peace and the stability of a free world. 9/11 was a tremendous tragedy. Perhaps worse is the terrible strategy that America's leaders pursued in reaction over the next two decades. We owe it to the brave souls who lost their lives on 9/11, to the amazing men and women of our armed forces who have battled, died, and lost on our behalf, and to each other to honestly assess and correct our reckless foreign and domestic policies born from 9/11. We must encourage real change in our foreign policy goals before the greatest nation that was ever predicated on the idea that government should be of, for, and by the people shall perish from this earth. So that's the view from the country today. Next, hardline House Republicans itching for shutdown and impeachment fights. This is from The Hill, published today, September 11th. Hardline Republicans in the House are itching for fights over opening an impeachment inquiry into President Biden and extracting deep spending cuts, even at the risk of a government shutdown. Their eagerness to fight isn't just with Biden and Democrats, but also with Republicans in their conference worried about the political risks of an impeachment fight and a shutdown. Those dynamics pose yet another challenge for Speaker Kevin McCarthy, whose job is to unify the conference. Quote, I'm tired of all these Republicans hiding behind, oh, but they'll say it's a shutdown, and they'll say you're defunding law enforcement with the Department of Homeland Security. That is all bullshit, said Representative Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas, a member of the House Freedom Caucus. The truth is, we're using the power that we were given to force change because you don't pay people not to do their job. Allies of McCarthy are among those putting the pressure on him. So here's my take on this. This is like, you know, this is the DC fight that they do to, like, every so often, whether it's the debt ceiling or continuing resolutions around the budget. Obviously, the fiscal year is ending. We don't have a new budget once again from our Congress. And here we are with these stupid shut down the government fights. And who's going to get blamed? You know what? As far as I'm concerned, they can shut down the government for a couple of years, right? The truth is that only about 15% of the government actually gets shut down. We can keep the necessary services running. Nothing's going to happen to the Department of Defense. You're going to get your Medicare check, your Social Security check. It's all just a game that Washington people play. And they wait until these points of leverage where, you know, they got to produce a budget and there is no budget, right? So everybody just hangs out and waits until this sort of last minute, like, you know, like young kids who don't properly prepare for an exam. They're now crash coursing on trying to get this government together. And I am concerned and disappointed in the speaker, Speaker McCarthy, in the sense that, you know, his promise was that we would have go back to a normal budget process, that each department would go through a committee with the bills and they'd be passed. And yet here we are. Our deficit is going to be $2 trillion. That's double what it was last year, which itself is, you know, a ridiculous record. I'm young enough to remember when $200 or $300 billion was an amazingly ridiculous amount of deficit by Ronald Reagan in the 80s. It's now 10 times that amount. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to do anything about it. And quite frankly, I'm not sure whether there's anything more to say about it. Next, we have updates on President Biden's trip overseas. He was at the G20 summit. He then stopped in, the G20 was in India. He then stopped in Hanoi. And this is just an update on the insane things that are happening with his ability to perform the job. So it almost pains me to talk about this, but I think you need to know. Incredible moment. White House staff abruptly end Biden's rambling Vietnam press conference mid-sentence and cut his mic. And this is from the Daily Mail. I know a lot of people aren't a fan of that, but sometimes this sort of news you can only get from them. unfortunately, President Biden held a press conference in Hanoi, Vietnam, Sunday night. It came to an abrupt end as the voice of his press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, suddenly interrupted his train of thought. And here's what this sounds like.
We talked about at the conference overall. We talked about stability. We talked about making sure that the third world, the southern hemisphere had access to change. It wasn't confrontational at all.
Thank you, everybody. This ends the press conference. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
So that's Joe, you know, rumbling, bumbling, stumbling, no coherent message, has no idea what he's saying. And then suddenly mic's cut. That's it. And they start playing some jazz music. And then this is another article, again, from the Daily Mail today. Biden calls climate deniers lying dog-faced pony soldiers and talks about Indians and John Wayne at very bizarre press conference with whispers, walking around, and jokes about softball questions from approved lists of reporters. President Joe Biden whispered, he walked about the stage, and he used that now famous phrase, lying dog-faced pony soldier, while taking questions Sunday night in Hanoi, Vietnam. So I'm not going to read much more of this. I mean, because it's been said before. If you listen to the podcast, if you read our blog on thecountry.news, it's actually hosted on Substack, you know that he shouldn't be the nominee. And I don't think he's going to be the nominee, but I bring this up because I still have folks that I say that to, and they look at me like I have six eyes. It's quite clear he's in cognitive decline. It's quite clear he is not... does not have the skills and the cognitive ability to be the leader of the free world. And quite frankly, the American people, they deserve better. And look, you know, I'm not super happy with the choice on the other side right now with Donald Trump. They deserve better than him as well. Speaking of which, our illustrious former president was in Iowa this weekend for the Iowa State game. While the video that he released showed, or you know, the audio was adjusted, so it sounded like everybody was excited to see him. There were a lot of jeers there, and you see other videos from other folks with a lot of middle fingers and a lot of booing. There was a banner that flew over the stadium asking, "Where's Melania?" And he, of course, is mired knee-deep, maybe neck-deep, in indictments. Two federal and two state indictments. And so, you know, he continues apace. And then our friend next, Elon Musk, was in the news again late last week and over the weekend over this controversy with Ukraine. And as I understand it, at some point in the past, the Ukraine military asked Mr. Musk to activate Starlink coverage. That's his space satellite. SpaceX launches satellites for Starlink, which is their internet product. It's based on satellites, of course. And they currently do not offer service in the Crimea for whatever reason. And this was true at the time. And the Ukrainian military, apparently, reporting is, they asked Mr. Musk to turn on coverage so they could execute a drone sub sneak attack on the Russian Navy, stationed at a port in Crimea. And Musk refused. And that is now being presented in some parts of the media and certainly some parts of the Twitter, the X, that he's treasonous. In fact, let me find the quote. Yeah, so this is from everybody's favorite superhero, the Hulk, Mark Ruffalo, who tweeted, he posted an article from The Guardian about this this dust-up, and Mark Ruffalo is quoting a Ukrainian official who says, "By not allowing Ukrainian drones to destroy part of the Russian fleet via Starlink interference, Elon Musk allowed this fleet to fire caliber missiles at Ukrainian cities. As a result, civilians and children are being killed." And in fact, you know, I've seen others write that because he did not provide the service, which again, it was not turned on. And he said, our terms of service say we don't support military operations or the attacks of military operations as part of this Starlink service. But nonetheless, folks are calling him a traitor and say that because he's another tweet from some random person was because he's a DOD contractor. And he refused service to an ally of the United States, he's committed treason. And I find this argument mind-blowing. I can't believe that this is what people actually think. I think it's an effort just to try and get Elon Musk, which that effort, as an aside, is growing significantly here in America. The DOJ sued SpaceX because some of their employments... postings, they're posting for open jobs, and they say you have to be an American citizen or be legal to work in the United States. The DOJ is suing him for that, and it comes out that they post in exactly the same manner. In other words, the DOJ themselves says, hey, we need you to be a United States citizen or authorized to work in the United States. So it's quite an effort to try and get Mr. Musk. In this case, you know, he's a private citizen with a private business, and there, you know, is no obligation on his or any American's part to have to support the foreign policy of the United States or provide significant effort to assist, Ukraine in such an attack. First, even if it was the United States attacking, he's not required to do that. Unless there's some sort of act of Congress or by law and that sort of thing. And second, this is the Ukraine. This is not America. He's an American citizen running an American company. He has no obligation to do anything on behalf of the folks of Ukraine. And in fact, he's probably done more than any business person around for the people of Ukraine in terms of providing that internet service and other things. You can look it up. And this line of attack is just another gotcha kind of thing with Elon. Look, he's human. He makes mistakes. I don't think he's 100% right, but man, I would find it hard pressed to find another human being in the world that's trying to do good on behalf of humanity. I mean, he started the EV car thing, which is to get off of fossil fuels, right? Started it, created that marketplace, and is driving it and is driving the cost down of EVs across all manufacturers. He started SpaceX, which is an effort to get to Mars and colonize another planet before we destroy this one. SpaceX has also been filling in for the absent NASA projects. Before Elon Musk and SpaceX came along, we were paying the Russians to fly our astronauts to the International Space Station. So he's obviously helped us out with that. You can argue Twitter. In my opinion, he saved Twitter and perhaps free speech. In America, the only reason we know about the Twitter files and some of the efforts that are now coming out in the press is because of him. and him releasing all of those files to journalists, who then documented how the FBI, the Homeland Security, the Department of the Defense, and other government agencies were requesting and receiving positive responses to pulling down American citizens' speech on the internet. And because of that effort, just recently, in fact, this was yesterday, I saw this from the New York Times. Appeals court rules White House overstepped First Amendment. The judges wrote that the White House and the Office of the Surgeon General had, quote, coerced the platforms to make their moderation decisions by way of intimidating messages and threats of adverse consequences, and significantly encouraged the platforms' decisions by commandeering their decision-making processes. That was just decided by a court of appeals around social media posting. So it's not just me, it's not just Elon, it's not just Fox News that is saying this. The White House, the Surgeon General, and others have been censoring speech in America in direct violation of the Constitution. He's also started the Boring Company, which is a underground train system that uses little to no energy to move people around, which obviously is could be a huge benefit for people in the future. He started Neuralink, which is an effort focused on optimizing the brain-computer interface, so connecting computers to brains, which sounds crazy, right? But, you know, one of the first things they're doing is they're helping people that have brain damage to do things like see or hear, which they couldn't because of these damages. And so that's the first step, is to help people that have significant brain injuries, even where they can't talk or speak or read and have no cognitive abilities, and see if they can't improve that. So that's obviously a positive. He did help start OpenAI and then left because he didn't like the way it was going. And he since started his own AI company, which from most people's perspective has a more broader eye towards the dangers of AI and how we might employ AI without it taking over like Skynet, right? So, again, he's a human. He does right things. He does wrong things. I don't agree with everything. But if I'm picking a guy to bet on to help humanity, I cannot think of a person more that I would trust more based upon not just what he says, but what he's done. These things that he's done to help humanity move forward in a positive way. There's nobody I'm betting on more than him. And you could take that to the bank. And then the last piece of news we want to cover today is, and this is from The Guardian as well, Google goes to trial in biggest U.S. challenge to tech power in decades. U.S. Justice Department accuses Google of monopolizing search space in landmark case to start on Tuesday. The trial in a landmark antitrust case against Google is scheduled to start on Tuesday in Washington District Court over charges of monopolizing the online search space. Gee, do you think? The suit filed by the U.S. Justice Department in 2020 represents the biggest legal challenge to the power and influence of big tech in decades and could be a bellwether in the fight against the industry's monopolies. The Google search trial will be hugely consequential for our digital world, where the outcome will determine how millions of Americans access and use the internet, said Catherine Van Dyke, senior counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project, a nonprofit that filed a motion to make court proceedings public due to the importance of the case. The Justice Department has accused Google of using its market power to unfairly lock out rivals and position itself as a gatekeeper of the web. The case marks the first brought by the government against Google to go to trial. The Justice Department has also joined a separate case against Google brought by the attorneys general of 38 states and territories over monopoly concerns in advertising. So, just like I have an affinity for Elon Musk and what he's trying to do in the world, I think that this lawsuit is a good thing for America. I think that Google started out with a phrase, famous phrase, that said, do no evil. And I think over time, since the founders have cashed out in some ways and become less involved with the company, they're doing significant evil. I don't think they have our best fortunes in mind. They run YouTube, which is probably the most totalitarian censor of content that still is commercially viable in the United States. I think they regularly censor speech that they disagree with politically, and they pretend like they're helping us. I think that they certainly dominate search. The last I looked, and I don't know the latest, but the last I heard, they do like 70-80% of both advertising and search on the internet. And it's about time we start to look into it and see if they haven't overstepped their bounds. Google could probably be 5 or 6 different really good companies. And, I think the intersection of big government and big corporations is the most fundamental problem in America today. There's little oversight. There's little challenge to it. And we find out over and over and over again after the fact how these big corporations, with either the government being entirely ineffective or in some cases in cahoots with these big corporations, we find out over and over again how much they've screwed the people to make money. As much as I'm a capitalist and as much as I believe in a free market economy, we have to build bigger, brighter, stronger walls between corporate America and the government. And we need to stop allowing our politicians to enrich themselves by doing favors for companies like Google. And so as it is September 11th, we will leave you today with some words from some of our greatest presidents. I'm going to share with you some information from President Abraham Lincoln and President John Kennedy. I hope you enjoy it. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And on the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it with war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. One-eighth of the whole population were colored slave, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war. While the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it, neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even be before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph, and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us not judge, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as we have said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. What kind of peace do I mean? What kind of peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I'm talking about genuine peace. The kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living. The kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace for all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense when a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we labor on, not toward a strategy of annihilation, but toward a strategy of peace. And that's The View from the Country.